Hey there, it's Dr. Nazanin Mo'oli, and I want to chat with you about a key ingredient for a fabulous date night, feeling sexy. And come on, let's be real. What you wear plays a big part in how you rock that confidence. That's why I'm thrilled to introduce you to Quince. Quince brings you premium European linen dresses, blouses, and shorts starting at just $30, along with washable silk tops, 40-karat gold jewelry, and more. And guess what? All of their goodies are priced 50 to 80% lower than similar brands. By teaming up directly with top factories, Quince skipped the middleman and hands us the saving. Plus, they stick to factories with safe, ethical practices and top-notch fabrics and finishes. How awesome is that? Picking from Quince's website was tough, because they have a ton of fabulous choices. I ended up going for their 100% washable silk sleep dress in champagne. And let me tell you, my husband was floored. He's convinced whoever rocks this is in for a blast. I'm going to record some content on that dress so you can see how fabulous is that dress. Elevate your date night style with Quince. Pop over to quince.com/sexology for free shipping on your order and 365-day returns. That's quince.com/sexology to get free shipping and 365-day returns. quince.com/sexology.
Welcome to Sexology, a podcast that untangles the science of sex and pleasure. And now, with this week's episode, your host, clinical psychologist, Dr. Nazanin Mo'oli.
Hello, and welcome to episode 132 of Sexology Podcast. I'm your host, Dr. Nazanin Mo'oli. Today, we're going to talk about what are some of the challenges that women and their partners who are in a relationship with those women who are struggling with kind of sexual desires and various sexual challenges, and more specifically, FSIAD, which is the female sexual interest arousal disorder, are facing. I'm super excited to have Dr. Natalie Rosen on our show. She did tons of wonderful research studies and couples who are struggling with sexual dysfunctions, and she shares some of her findings and of her studies in this interview with us. Dr. Natalie Rosen is an associate professor in the Department of Psychology and Neuroscience at Dalhousie University in Halifax. Her research interests focus on understanding how individuals and especially couples cope with sexual problems or changes to their sexual relationship, including low sexual desire. She is an associate editor of the Journal of Archives of Sexual Behavior and has published over 70 peer-reviewed articles and book chapters on sexual relationships. She also has a private practice. She's exclusively worked with couples on sex and couple therapy. You can find a link to her website in our show notes. And without further ado, here's our conversation with Dr. Natalie Rosen. Hello and welcome to another episode of Sexology Podcast. I am excited and honored to have Dr. Natalie Rosen on our show today. Dr. Natalie, welcome to our show.
Hi.
I am so excited to have you on the show because you have done all this exciting research around different things around sexuality and women's and men's relationship as it comes to sex. And unfortunately, as you probably know, that we don't have many labs focusing on these areas of research. So we're very grateful for your work.
Mm-hmm. Thanks for having me.
One of the research articles that you published was talking about female sexual interest arousal disorder. Can you tell us a little bit about this disorder?
Sure. So female sexual interest arousal disorder, FSIAD, is actually a new diagnosis in the fifth edition of the Diagnostic and Statistical Manual of Mental Disorders, the DSM. And it's a combination now of what was previously known as hypoactive sexual desire disorder and female sexual arousal disorder. And those two are no longer in the DSM, and we have this new diagnostic entity, FSIAD, which is somewhat of a combination of the two. It reflects both of them. So women diagnosed with FSIAD endorse three or more symptoms relating to low desire or little sort of thinking about sex, not initiating sex. Those ones kind of tap into the desire side. And then three of the other symptoms relate to a lack of pleasure during sex or not being sort of responsive to cues related to sex or having some kind of difficulties with physical arousal. So for the diagnosis, though, women only need to endorse three or more of the symptoms. So they can still sort of more tap into the desire side or more tap into the arousal side. And it has to be for at least 6 months and accompanied by significant distress.
How interesting. So if there's no distress, then it's not FSIAD.
That's right. Yeah. So distress is absolutely a key part of it. Lots of people experience, you know, ebbs and flows in the desire, and oftentimes for really, you know, reasonable reasons why women might not be interested in sex right now. So they might have just had a baby, or there might be some kind of health crisis that they're dealing with, or their partner lost their job, or, you know, there's all sorts of reasons why there might be a period of time where a woman is not feeling that interest in sex. And so in that context, she might not be that distressed by it. It might not be causing problems for herself or for her relationship. And in those circumstances, no, it would not be FSIAD.
And I'm so glad that you talked about this and you're normalizing it, because our sexuality does not exist in vacuum. So of course, if you just had a child, or if you're having like acute depression or mood challenges or anything in the context of relationship, that can impact our sexuality. So this is not necessarily a disorder in those cases.
Exactly. And actually, there's some other, you know, great research out there that says it's actually more normal to experience kind of ebbs and flows in your desire over time in your relationship than to systematically kind of maintain high desire. That's not really what it looks like in most sort of long-term couples.
And that's, I think, fantastic to kind of mention and talk about it. Thank you for that point, because I feel like sometimes people feel they are kind of like the expectation from media and all this things that they're reading is like they gotta be a sex machine all the time, and they gotta be on. So as you said, it's normal to have these ebbs and flows. Mm-hmm. How common is FSIAD though?
So you're
I'm
asking
curious about the prevalence. Yes.
Oh, how common? Sorry, I didn't hear that question properly. Yeah. So it's kind of tricky actually to estimate right now, because it is a new diagnosis, right? So we don't have a lot of population-based estimates yet, since it only sort of came out as an entity in 2013. But if we look at, you know, estimates of the previous diagnoses of HSDD and FSAD, we typically think that it's around 7 to 23% of the general population. And that's a bit of a range there. But as I said, I think that, you know, over the next few years, we'll get a better sense of the prevalence. But I expect it's going to be lower than the previous diagnosis of HSDD, which is the low desire diagnosis. And that's because there is a bit of evidence that came out, some of Dr. Lori Brado's work recently, that suggests that women, when they sort of compared women who meet the criteria for both, that the women with FSIAD tended to endorse more severe symptoms than the previous diagnosis of HSDD. So the prevalence somewhere in the 7 to 23%, potentially a bit on the lower end.
And it's significantly sounds like 7 to 23 is a huge kind of range of people kind of struggling with this. Yeah. And it's great that there are kind of grants and research around what people can do for treatment. But what I specifically loved about your research that you looked at the impact of this diagnosis and the partners. Yes. And I see, like, in my practice all the time, when couples coming in and one person is struggling with something, more or less, in at least I would say, like in most of the cases, it's impacting their partners. So tell us, how does this diagnosis of FSIAD is that impacting the partners?
Yeah. Basically. Yeah, and I would actually argue, you know, I totally agree with you. I see this clinically as well in my private practice that, you know, in the context of sexuality, where two people, you know, sex is typically or often happening between the two people, even more so than other problems, other potential mental health problems, both members of the couple are impacted. And traditionally, including in desire, but in other areas of sexual dysfunction as well, we've tended to focus on just the person with the problem. Mm-hmm. Like it's their problem and they're the one who's supposed to get treatment for it. I know clinically, you know, sex therapists often see both members of the couple, but certainly in research, we haven't really known a lot about these relationship dynamics because there's been this focus on just the person with the diagnosis. And that's really what's been driving my research. When I looked at sort of the literature and the state of things in clinically low desire in women, I was just shocked at how little attention there was to the partner and sort of the relationship dynamics and the impacts for the partner. So that was really what led to this first study. And what we saw, again, not surprisingly, given, you know, your own experience as well, was that the partners were suffering as well. So they were reporting lower sexual satisfaction, higher sexual distress, poor sexual communication compared to partners of women. So we could collected also a control sample where we specifically screened for couples that were not having any kind of sexual dysfunction, and those control partner, you know, were doing much better. And then among the men in the sample, because we did have same-sex couples as well, but when we looked at just the male partners, they were reporting more difficulties with orgasm, more erectile difficulties, lower satisfaction with intercourse compared to these control partners.
That is fascinating. How was it similar or different in the same-sex couples?
Yeah, so with the same-sex couples, we only had 9. So it's really not a big enough sample for us to have been able to compare the female partners to know, you know, whether they were seeing similar difficulties. I don't think there's any reason to expect that they wouldn't. Like, I would imagine that female partners of women with FSIAD are also less satisfied and more distressed than female partners of women who don't have this problem.
Mm-hmm. Right. And my background is in the system, kind of like theories, and I can totally see like when there's a challenge in the relationship part of mm-hmm. the system that impacts the kind of the entire couples and the family and all of those connected. So I was kind of curious to see that what are some of the possible connections that you made between mm-hmm. these women and their partners' lower sexual and relationship well-being?
Yeah, and before we get to that, actually, I forgot to mention one thing that I think was really interesting that I wanted to say, is that even though the partners were reporting this lower sexual satisfaction and these sexual function difficulties, their actual level of sexual desire did not differ from the controls. Huh. So they experienced all these consequences, but they were still having desire for sex with their female partner at the same level as these control couples. So one of the things that suggested to us was that these couples are probably dealing with a larger desire discrepancy mm-hmm. than other couples. And desire discrepancy also has negative implications for couples and is a really common, you know, presenting problem for sex therapy.
Mm-hmm. And I think that's such an important point that you mentioned. And tell us, is it that, and I know that in the research you might have not looked at it, but I'm kind of curious about your clinical experience mm-hmm. with it, that does this couple usually had a closer baseline and then because of this FSIAD, the discrepancy mm-hmm. got worse, or mm-hmm. there always been this huge gap?
Yeah, that's an interesting question. You know, I'm just thinking, we don't know that from research, but clinically, because I do see a lot of these couples, and I'd love to hear your thoughts as well. But I typically, when I see the couples that have, where they're complaining about a desire discrepancy where the woman has lower desire, they often talk about how there was always a discrepancy there, that her desire was never like quite at the same place as her partner's, and maybe it's gotten worse over time. That's what I tend to see. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Well, yeah, I definitely agree with you. And also there's this tiny part of the population that I see at times they're coming in because this discrepancy grew significantly because of like aging or mm-hmm. because of the medical procedure that they had. But you're right. Usually
that's kids.
Right, kids for sure.
Yeah, that's the biggest one I see.
Yes, yeah. That people get shocked how the sexuality absolutely kind of changes afterward. Yeah. But so I think that could be part of it. But usually you're right that there is, when there's a discrepancy there, that's been in the relationship, discrepancy from the beginning.
Right. So coming back to your question about the possible connections, like how could the woman who has FSIAD, how is that going to affect her partner? Is that what your question was?
Absolutely.
Yeah, yeah. So I actually think there's a number of different ways that could that this could affect the partner. So one of the ones that sort of that kind of fits with theory around how people develop sexual problems is the possibility that like the partner may start to become kind of either preoccupied with or just more focused on signals or signs from the woman that maybe she's not interested in sex or not feeling aroused during sex. And that becomes really distracting for them. It draws their attention away from any potential pleasurable sensations that they're having and enhances their own anxiety. And so then sort of that idea of performance anxiety goes up, and then that can link to difficulties with their own erectile functioning and their own orgasm and satisfaction. So that's one thought about how the partner's impacted. Another piece that's sort of in line with that is really just this idea that I think the partners are kind of picking up on cues from the woman. So if the partner thinks that, you know, she might just be having sex to please him or her, or, they're doing it just, you know, not because they're that interested in having sex, but for these other sort of reasons to avoid a fight or this kind of thing, then the partners kind of pick up on that. And that also interferes with their satisfaction. And those are called what we know are called more avoidance-oriented goals for having sex. So having sex to sort of avoid some kind of negative relationship outcome. And what we know from some of my other research and research by others is that partners like are able to sense that more avoidance-oriented reasons for having sex, and that links to their lower sexual and relationship satisfaction.
Well, also, I was kind of very curious about the communication piece. Mm-hmm. So I can imagine that in the bedroom, if you feel and see that your partner is not into it, mm-hmm. that certainly mm-hmm. can take a toll on your excitement. But how is that kind of like being in that dynamic impact mm-hmm. your communication?
Yeah, that's a great question. I think what happens sometimes for some couples is that they might start to avoid talking about the problem because it has all these negative emotions that it kind of provokes in them. Or what I often see as well, or we might hear, is that partners don't want to feel like they're pressuring the woman to have sex. They don't want to be seen as kind of, you know, obligating them or putting pressure on them. So they start to avoid or pull back from initiating. And they also don't want to feel rejected. They don't want to, like, that feeling, and that's sort of those negative emotions, whether it's guilt or pressure or feeling, you know, rejected by your partner makes you feel bad. Those can all sort of, like, lead to the couple, and the woman's also experiencing all these negative emotions and guilt and et cetera, that they start to avoid talking about it. Mm-hmm. And that avoidance can really reinforce those patterns because people tend to avoid things that are bad, right? So why would they avoid something that's good? So, and then that avoidance just kind of reinforces this idea that this is a massive problem and that they can't handle it.
And at times I feel that people, they don't know there's solutions out there. So they have this kind of like dead end conversation that, why don't you desire me? Why don't mm-hmm. you initiate sex? And the partner say like, I just don't. And then they don't know where to go from that. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So I think research like yours, and I think like sex therapists that there are kind of familiar with kind of treatments of this dysfunctions can be very helpful tools.
Exactly. And it's also, I think it's about, they don't know where to go. And they also, it feels very threatening for the couple because, you know, the idea that is, you know, out there for sure in the media is that sex is really important to couple relationships. So when your sex life's not going that well, it can feel like a big threat to the relationship. And that also triggers a lot of negative emotions and again, makes you not want to deal with it and not talk about it.
Right. And I think this can kind of transition to the next question mm-hmm. that I want to understand that what are some of the recommendations that you have for couples who have like interpersonal challenges and sexual mm-hmm. challenges in the context of FSIAD?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So, I mean, part of it is just tapping into exactly what you just mentioned, which is that they don't have to be on their own about this, right? Mm-hmm. If they don't know what to do, that there is professional help available with sex therapists and clinical psychologists with experience in sex therapy to help them navigate and learn new ways of either reinforcing or stimulating their desire as a couple, like not just that it's the woman's problem that she needs to do something about her desire, but it's also about the patterns that they've started to engage in together that are not, you know, allowing them to connect in this way. So the first, you know, kind of recommendation is that there is professional help, particularly if they're distressed, right? So if they're not distressed and it's not a problem for them, then they might not need help. But if one or both members are feeling like this is causing a lot of conflict and they're upset about it, then they should go together as a couple. That's the first recommendation. Kind of following from that, and this is an easy one that I suggest to, you know, everyone who contacts me because I have a bit of a wait list, as I'm sure you do as well, is like, you know, what can I do right away? They want help and they're on the wait list, is that there's actually some really excellent books out there, self-help books that they can start out with and start reading. And this can be really helpful for a couple of reasons. One is that it starts to open up the conversation, mm-hmm. especially if they've been avoiding talking about it. So it gives couples sort of a language and a shared purpose in that they're both reading potentially the same book and they can have conversations about it. And it also makes sure that, you know, they're kind of on the same page. So the two books that I tend to recommend, one, and these might even be people you've spoken with before, is Come As You Are by Emily Nagoski.
We had her on this show.
Mm-hmm. Had her on the show. So yeah. Emily's amazing, and her book is amazing. Mm-hmm. And it's a great start, and it's fairly recent too, so it's really up to date. And that book is a real go-to for me in terms of women's sexual desire and arousal, and I think it's really useful for the partner to read it as well. And there's nice little exercises and little mm-hmm. things to do in there as well. The other one is Dr. Lori Brado's recent book.
I love her too. She was in the podcast too. And great book.
Exactly. Yes. So mindful sex. And that one is, you know, integrating, as you know, concepts of mindfulness and applying it to sexuality, which can be really useful too. So that's like often a starting point, especially for couples that might take them a while to get in for help. That's something that they could be doing at home. And again, really encouraging both members of the couple, like do some of the reading and then they can talk about it or look at some of the couple exercises or individual exercises that are in there. The other piece that I think, the other recommendation, and this comes from a study with our couples that is not quite out. It's accepted for publication, but it's not out yet. So I can give you a sneak preview.
Yay!
Is talking about this concept of self-expansion in couples. Hmm. So self-expansion has to do with broadening your sense of self. So engaging in a novel, interesting, exciting new activity with your partner, something that allows you to maybe see your partner in a new light in a way that you never really saw them before. It makes you feel like you're learning something new together. And at the same time, because you're doing this activity together, there's an intimacy component too, because it's shared. So what we found is that couples where the woman has FSIAD are actually reporting lower levels of self-expansion in their relationship. So they're not engaging in this type of activities or having these experiences with their partner to as great an extent as the control women. However, when women reported higher self-expansion, it was linked to their higher desire and sexual satisfaction. So let me give you some examples of what I mean by self-expansion. So self-expansion would be some examples might be taking a new class together. So maybe signing up for dance class or a cooking class or a lecture, going to a lecture where they hear some new and interesting ideas. Another example would be visiting a new site, a new city together, or exploring, you know, going on a new hike or a hike that you've never done before, sort of challenging yourself physically together would be another example. So the idea is really about finding a shared activity that's new, that's introducing something novel and challenging that you're doing together with your partner. And what we're seeing is that this idea of self-expansion might be really beneficial for women's desire.
That's fantastic. And kind of congruent with what I see in my practice, because sometimes people coming in and it seems like they are living in this very kind of rigid routine. And I know it could be part of being an adult, but I think that can kind of like create this sense of expectancy that I know what my partner is thinking.
Exactly.
I know what she's feeling, he's feeling. So there's not necessarily an element of novelty. And
exactly.
I love that what you talked about, that like maybe doing something that's a shared interest and shared activity that can kind of help people with seeing each other in a different light.
Yeah, but they get confused. And so you have to, I always have to clarify, it's not the same thing as going to see a movie together. Mm-hmm. It's not the same thing as like watching your favorite TV show, because that's what you're already doing, mm-hmm. right? That's what you're already doing together. And you're going to be sitting there beside your partner, and they're going to, and you've already seen them sit and watch that movie together, right? That's not like showing you a new perspective, and it's not like broadening your sense of self. It's very different than, let's say, going to see an art exhibit that when you never go to see art exhibits before, and it makes you sort of have these conversations you've never had before. You see your partner appreciating something that, you know, you didn't really realize they would like have this interest in Picasso or whatever it might be, but oh, like you're learning something new and you're sharing that experience. That's self-expansion. It's not self-expansion to do the sort of same usual right. things, right?
Right, more of the same. Yes.
Yeah,
yes,
exactly.
That makes sense.
Yeah. And it's hard for them to figure out what that might look like. And it doesn't have to be buying a plane ticket to New York City, especially if you don't have a lot of money, right? But that it's sort of trying to figure out what that could look like within the context of your life.
I guess the other question that I have that you may or may not kind of like looked into it, does it matter if self-expansion is in the context of sexual things or if it's just kind of like an everyday thing that people are doing that they are like equally kind of like impactful?
Yeah, yeah. So I get that question a lot. And in our study, we did not look at it like particularly in a sexual context. So we did not look at, you know, couples who were like more experimental or doing more variety in their sex lives. We just looked at this idea, this more general concept of like shared self-expansion in their relationships outside of the bedroom. It's possible that some people could have interpreted some of the questions to also in the bedroom, but that's not really what we looked at. We know that generally from other areas and other research that like more flexibility in the bedroom, a little bit of experimentation, that these things tend to be good for people's sex lives. And from some of the work of Peggy Kleinplatz, who's also Canadian, who does work on sort of optimal sexuality, and she's interviewed people who really like have these fantastic sex lives. And in her research, this idea of, you know, being open to trying new things and experimental, like this is all, and you know, respectful at the same time, those are things that can contribute to, you know, really satisfying sex lives. But in our case, I don't think it has to be about that.
And I think that's very positive as well, because sometimes when people have sexual challenges, like FSIAD or any other sexual challenges, the last thing they want to do is kind of more things around sex.
Yes, exactly.
So I think like doing new things that are not necessarily sexual might give them more motivation to kind of explore things.
Yeah. And the example I also like to give as sort of really showing what self-expansion looks like is I say to couples sometimes, you know, have you ever seen your partner at work, like doing something that they really excel in? We don't really have that many opportunities to like see our partner, whether they're a lawyer or they're a teacher or whatever they are. Like if, let's say they're a teacher in the classroom, like, you know, we're not in the classroom with them. But if you do get, when you do get that peek into, like, because you saw a piece of your partner, like, receiving an award or performing in some way, it's like, you feel that spark of, like, yeah, like, that's a piece of them that, like, I don't really get exposed to, but it kind of, yeah, they're sexy up there giving that talk. And it sort of sparks that desire to see your partner in their element and challenging themselves. That's kind of a component of self-expansion as well, as like seeing your partner do something, challenge themselves or excel at something that you don't necessarily see in your day-to-day life.
I love that. Sounds like such a novel and exciting new findings that you had in the article. So I can't wait to read it. So I noticed that we are toward the end of our time, and I want to people know where they can find your research studies and about your private practice, because I know that you've studied this range of different things around sex and sexuality. So tell us a little bit about your kind of research and also the private practice.
Sure. So generally, you know, all of my research, what I'm most interested in is couples and how couples together navigate sexual problems. So there's this FSIAD work, but I've also been working for a really long time with couples where the woman experiences pain during sex. And then the other area that I'm really interested in is the transition to parenthood, which is all fraught with all sorts of new sexual and relationship challenges, and how couples navigate that transition, who sort of bounces back. And that's really been informed by my clinical research. As I mentioned before, I do see a lot of couples who see that sort of having their first kid be quite a turning point in their sex lives, where, you know, even 3-5 years later, they're really struggling to get back their feelings of desire and satisfaction. So I also do work in that area. And I also have some new research around couples who are coping with fertility issues as well, which is, again, a big sort of burden and challenge, and introduces these new components about why you're having sex, with the reproductive, more of a reproductive focus. So any of those sort of sexual challenges and problems is an area I'm interested in. And they can go, people can go to my website, which is natalieorosen.com, to read about some of the past research and current research. We have links to a lot of the paper research articles on there. There's also a link to my private practice, which is quite small because I do spend the majority of my time with research, but I have a very small private practice here in Halifax, working with couples around issues of sexual dysfunction and problems. And then the last thing I'll just mention is that even though we've talked a lot about FSIAD today, in the DSM, there still is the equivalent diagnosis of a hypoactive sexual desire disorder for men, so male men who are struggling with low desire, which we have been slowly, because it is, it's not as common, and I think there's a number of societal barriers as well to sort of men coming forward with this problem. But we are interested in working with those couples as well and collecting some data on how they are coping and managing it and sort of the relationship dynamics when it's the man who has low desire, both same-sex couples and mixed-sex couples. So that one in particular, if any of your listeners are, you know, struggling with that problem or interested in contributing to research, they can go to the website and get in touch with us because we'd love to hear from them.
Excellent, excellent. And I'm so glad that you are doing that research, because I oftentimes talk about low desire in women. And a few weeks ago, I got this email from one of our listeners that she was talking about, you know, in my relationship, it's opposite. And my partner, who is a male, doesn't have that much desire. And that's wonderful that you're doing that research. So I encourage our listeners to definitely check out and contact you guys if they're interested to be part of it.
That would be great.
Yes, yes. Thank you so much for being on the show. This was absolutely our pleasure to have you here. And we cannot wait to hear about your future research.
Thank you for having me.
I hope you enjoyed my conversation with Dr. Natalie Rosen. I love that she talked about this concept of self-expansion. And I often talk to my clients about the benefit of them trying something exciting together or new together inside the bedroom or outside the bedroom. This is something I personally incorporate in life, because at time, at least based on my clinical experience, I see that people are kind of like overestimating how much they know their partner. They kind of like paint this image of the partner in a kind of one-dimensional way, which might get in the way of kind of experiencing sexual excitement toward that partner. So if you're doing something new and kind of like see things from different lenses, that can help with your sexuality. And this is my husband and I, we do lots of new exciting things together, like physical activities and traveling. And I find that that's very helpful for my relationship. So I encourage you guys to look into it as well. The other thing is, if you are struggling with sexual interest issues or sexual dysfunctions, and that's something that you guys want to work on, and you live in California, you can work with us. My practice, it's me and another therapist who works with people who are struggling with sexual dysfunctions. So we would be happy to help you. You can come into our office in LA if you live in LA. And also we provide video counseling. So we would be happy to help you. And if we are not good fit for what you're looking for, we can always connect you to our colleagues locally. Anyhow, I hope you enjoyed this show. If you like the show, please consider sharing it with your friends so we can reach a broader audience, and we would really appreciate it. Have a wonderful day, and I'll talk to you guys next week.
Thanks for listening to the Sexology Podcast. For more great content, visit www.sexologypodcast.com. Please be advised that information presented on this podcast is not a substitute for seeking help from a licensed mental health provider.